This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this podcast. I'm Mark Stephen and this is Mr. Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, very different programme this week because we're at the Royal Highland Show, the 200th Royal Highland Show. And no matter where you are in the world, wherever you're listening to this, there's a fair chance that some of the livestock lines that are here today will have had some input into the cattle in your country. This is truly international.
We are in the cattle hall and we've specifically come here because this is the Aberdeen Angus line. And the quality of animal that is here today is just staggering. They are beautifully turned out. They're all bedded in big, billowing bales of, you know, sort of golden straw. They look fantastic, these black animals, but as you say, the bloodlines of these animals can probably be found in just about every corner of the globe.
What's interesting about the Aberdeen Angus is during the 60s, they were very much a hobby cattle and they got smaller and smaller and smaller. And they actually went back to Canada to get their much bigger, bulky animals and did artificial insemination, which has resulted in these beasts that you've got here at the moment. So, you know, they went abroad and then it came back.
So wherever you are listening to this podcast, there will be a connection between you and what's happening here at Ingolstadt. We're standing here at the 200th Royal Highland Show here at Ingolstadt in Edinburgh. We are delighted, as everyone is, to be back here at the showground after a gap of a couple of years. With me to enjoy the sights, sounds, tastes and particularly smells of Scotland's largest agricultural show, Mr. Ewan McElroy.
Yeah, we're not live this morning, but get in touch via email. That's outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. And we do love hearing from you. And as Mark said, we haven't been here for a couple of years, since 2019. But that's ramped up the excitement, not just for us, but all round. I mean, you can almost feel that excitement.
Yeah, it's actually, there's been lots of smiles on faces because, let's face it, the agricultural community, and this is the biggest event in their calendar, haven't been able to mix, as none of us have, across the sort of period of COVID and things. So to get the chance to come back together again, face to face, and actually experience things live and in the flesh is a great thing. If you aren't coming here, hopefully over the next 90 minutes we'll give you a thorough sense of what you're missing. Coming up, the virtues of goats. They make great pets, apparently. We've got the world's cutest sheep. There's no argument about that at all. And how is Scottish agriculture working towards food sustainability and security? Because those really seem to be the key topics at this year's show.
Yeah, it's actively, maybe not with a lot of people just here for a sunny day out and an ice cream, but there's a real atmosphere amongst the agricultural community about the way ahead. And they're starting to have that conversation, which is exciting and really necessary.
As I said, this is the 200th anniversary of the Royal Highland Show, and here's someone who remembers that first event.
Well, it's not quite like that, but I have been coming here for a very, very long time. It wasn't in colour, obviously, in those days. Anyway, I thought with it being such a notable anniversary, I'd take a wee look back at how all this started. In the wee small hours of the year 1822... a group of Highland gentlemen cracked open another bottle of the finest Highland malt. The fire crackled and spat with the resin of Caledonian pine gathered the year before and brought down to the capital. The men, the elite movers and shakers of the Highland society, were excited. A plan was before them that could change Scottish farming forever. Since 1784, the Royal Highland and Agricultural Society of Scotland had encouraged their tenant farmers and workers to embrace new working techniques and technology that would improve the productivity of Scottish land. Local agricultural societies had been established across the country to help inform and to educate. but the stroke of genius had been the formation of the local farm show. Competition between farmers for the best cattle, the best sheep and the best horses had always existed. But a show took it to new heights. There is nothing a Scottish farmer enjoys more than to take the red rosette or the cup and be acknowledged as the top farmer in the county. But these landed gentry were about to take this new phenomenon to another level. Winning locally was fine, but to be the best in Scotland, to be the champion breeder, to be quite simply Scotland's top farmer, well, that was an incentive to take advantage of every tip, every technique and every advantage that was out there. And so the Highland Show was born. The Highlands looked to their best animals, and where better to show than in the capital, Edinburgh. In 1822, in the lee of Arthur's Seat, and in the exact location of the Scottish Parliament today, country came to town and simply took it over, as they do to this day. Old farmers from the Straths and Glens, young bloods from the Mearns and the Borders, husbands, wives, sons, daughters, children of the Celtic soil. And it's said that in the twilight hours of 1822, as they tended their stock, drams were drunk, stories were told, cattle were brushed, and drams were drunk, as they are to this day. It was a huge success, with 1,000 visitors and takings of over £52. And so began an incredible journey that 200 years later would see almost 200,000 visitors to the four-day sell-out event at Ingleston. But initially, the show went on the road, every year between Scotland's towns and cities. Perth, Stirling, Strathclyde, Aberdeen, Lothian, Borders, Dumfries and Galloway and Highland all played host to the Highland Show. It was a runaway success, and the Highland, as it was known, attracted farmers, landowners and, of course, royalty. This from Inverness in 1948, and the show gets a new name. It becomes the Royal Highland Show.
The King, the Queen and Princess Margaret, opening their Scottish tour, go to Inverness, capital of the Highlands, to give a royal title to the Highland Agricultural Show. Scotland's finest livestock is on parade. Emphasis is indeed on Highland, for breeds always associated with Scotland are well represented.
And that royal patronage continued, this time in 1958 in Aberdeen.
Scottish agriculture in all its departments was well represented, as always, at the Royal Highland Show held this year at Aberdeen. No exhibits north of the border are ever more popular than the picturesque Highland cattle, distinctive as the glens, mountains and mists of the romantic land itself. The Scottish farmers are well to the fore in the use of machinery, a fact noted by colourful cattlemen over here from Wyoming. They saw latest methods of shifting hay. Without mechanical aids, farming in Britain would nowadays be impossible.
2 years later, and the clamour for a permanent site was growing. The show was now massive. Simply too much for regional organisers, trying to find space where demand outstripped supply. And so, in 1960, money changed hands, and the remains of a golf course were ripped up, and Scottish agriculture was coming home. Home to Ingolstadt.
You don't often get royal weather at the Royal Highland Show, but that's what it was this year at Ingolstadt. In fact, on this day, it was a royal occasion all round, as it should have been for the visit of the president of the show, Her Majesty the Queen Mother. Last-minute touches were applied in the competitions for the best kept and best decorated harness. On show here were scores of living reasons why prime Scotch beef stays in big demand. One of the best ever Royal Highland Shows.
A potted history of the Royal Highland Show celebrating 200 years this year. And we're at Ingolstadt this week, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if this is looked back on as being one of the best ever Highland Shows. There have been a couple of changes, however, and we've got more on that later.
Yeah, they've reduced the numbers for safety reasons. It's actually a more pleasant event. If you've been at the Highland Show, you know, the Highland Show shuffle.
Yes.
Whereas you can actually walk quite freely and you get closer to the animals. We are kind of leaning over, looking at the shorthorn bulls at the moment.
Trying to pretend to be farmers.
And well, it's a wonderful thing to be. What you can do is, what I do love about this, is you can have competitions amongst yourselves.
We've never, ever, ever got this right. Not once. How many years have we been coming here getting this wrong?
Some skill in being a judge. But what a day, you know. It's just, it's early on. Beautiful, clear blue skies. Yeah. And as you said at the start, just so many people enjoying themselves.
Yeah. And oceans and oceans and oceans of fake tan. Have you noticed?
Yes, mine's coming along now.
I wish. There is, of course, loads to see and do here at the show. Fun for all the family. But there's a very serious side to these proceedings, because there are big issues facing Scottish agriculture at the moment. Rising inflation, agflation they call it, is the talk of the town just now, with the highest rate since the 1970s. The baseline is 9.1%. That's for the rest of us. For farmers, it's gone through the roof, basically, as President of the National Farmers Union in Scotland, Martin Kennedy, explained.
Farmers are facing 100% on fuel, they're facing 100% on feed, they're facing 250% increase in fertiliser, which is absolutely required for the whole industry. So we're not, if farmers could probably suck that up at 9.1%, we could do that. It would be a challenge. But right now what we're facing, these input costs, the fertiliser cost alone for a bale of silage was £3, it's now £11. Now try to take that into context, it's massive.
If farmers aren't going to produce as much, what implications does that have for both governments, Scottish governments and UK governments' policies on food sustainability, food security?
Absolutely massive. I mean, food security, we're now hearing it coming from Westminster as well, which we haven't heard up until last week. It was fine to hear it, but they need to really take that on board seriously. I think the Scottish government are taking it more seriously now. But the implications on it, I mean, regardless of what anybody says, we're still a wealthy nation here in the UK, and we're certainly still wealthy throughout Europe as well. And if we don't produce it here, then we will import it from somewhere else, because we can afford to import it from somewhere else. But we've got to remember the implications that will have on other peoples from other parts of the world who are not in the same position to produce food in a sustainable fashion. I mean, we can do it sustainably here. We know that. We've got the climate. COP26 was a classic example. I welcomed people to one of the events on a horrible wet day in Glasgow. But the chap from Kenya that was on the panel with me thought this was a fantastic day, and yet we take it for granted. You know, rain is something we sometimes curse. However, you can see even the grass here at the Highland Show, it's green, and it's green because we've got the climate to do it.
With this current situation, it would suggest we should be producing more, and we're really facing much less production. And you're getting it from a couple of sides. You know, there's the input costs. We've got a lot of environmental pressure as well, saying, oh, we need to rewild, we need to give it to wildlife, all which are practical arguments, but it's a difficult circle to square.
It is. I think we can actually do that, though. If we base this on food security and food production, we can do that, and we've already seen, and we've lobbied strongly for that need for still having direct support within Scotland, when we see that recognised by the Scottish Government, but we need to put some conditionality on that as well, and look at some of the climate change measures we can actually make, look at some of the biodiversity things we can actually make, and it's a, sort of that holistic approach. And the reality is, just now, we don't have that policy options available, and that's what we're trying to drive with Scottish Government just now, so we can put in things like wildlife corridors, that we can link up farms. It would be a great benefit, not just for climate change, but in terms of sequestration, but also in terms of biodiversity wildlife corridors, which would be fantastic. We can all play our part. We don't need to put things in blanket forestry. We do want to integrate where we can do these things from a biodiversity point of view, because at the minute we've got 3,000 agri-environment schemes in play presently, and you've got to reach a certain number of points to get involved in that. You're far better having 17 or 18,000 businesses doing a small amount that are all linked up together than a few doing a lot and the rest not doing anything.
Going back to Ewan's original point, you know, underlying rate of inflation is 9.1%. Farmers are facing anything up to 250, 300% inflation on things like, you know, on certain inputs. How do you fix that? What's the solution?
I think the solution is, in terms of end product price, we could take it if the end product price was up. It doesn't need to come up a lot. The value of carrots in a plate of carrot soup is 4 pence. If somebody said, make it 8 pence, would that make a huge difference to the consumer? I don't think so.
But would the farmer get the 4 pence extra? That's what we want to mean.
And that's exactly where our concerns are, and that's exactly why we're trying to address this through the Grocery Code Adjudicator, looking at a far greater range and taking in the primary producer's concerns about that fairness in supply chain. That needs to be looked at. That can't just simply be a benefit to the supermarket, the retailer, the processor. That has has to come back to the primary producer, and there's an obligation on them to make sure that it can actually be secured as well, because if they don't, and I don't see in the future the ability to be able to import their way out of this, is what's happened up to now. We're looking at the minute, we've got a pig sector, which is a really important sector in Scotland, and we're still importing 40% of our pork in the UK. It's really not a great statistic to be proud of, and yet we're seeing our own sector going under.
Is that message getting across to people? I mean, there's always a danger of crying wolf for so long, but actually you're a real critical point. I mean, looking at your survey, some of it's really disturbing, really. 10% cut in cereal this year because I can't afford it or I can't get the fertiliser. 30% people coming out of pigs, people getting rid of entire dairy herds. This is getting quite serious.
It's really serious. This is unprecedented. We were already suffering from the issues around serious labour issues off the back of Brexit. We've got the whole input costs that have risen so high in the Ukraine crisis. It's all coming together now. And I mean, people talk about a perfect storm. Right now, that's what the agricultural industry is facing. But don't get me wrong, the agricultural industry is very adaptable. They will adapt to change. They will adapt to change that will suit their own business. And given off the results off the back of that survey, that's highlighted what that adaptation would take. It's going to be a contraction in production. So the implications, coming back to Mark's point, is going to be even greater on the wider infrastructure. And that's where we recognise the Highland Show, all the trade stands, everybody that's on here today relies on profitable agriculture or they wouldn't be here. So it's the wider economic output that's of greater concern, not just farmers. It's the wider implications on the consumer, on the trade, on the whole economy and our ability to adapt and do our measures for climate and biodiversity.
Is Scottish farming optimistic about the future?
I am, and I know a lot of the industry is really concerned, but I'm optimistic. My glass has always been half full because I think we've got one of the best industries in the world. We've got something we can be really proud of. We've talked about that for a long time, and I think the profile of food security, because it's now coming up the agenda, both governments and globally as well. COP27 is in Egypt this year. Now, we know climate change is obviously the big reason for COP27, but given what's happening in Egypt right now, where is that going to be in terms of food security? Which one's going to be the highest, given they're needing 80% of their grain coming from Ukraine? They can't get it. So that puts a bit of reality into it. So I think from a food producer's point of view, we've got some tough times to get through, some seriously tough times to get through. Once we get through these tough times, I think we'll maybe be recognised for the first time for a long time of what agriculture provides, not just by way of food, but in terms of climate, doing things sustainably and trying to help the environment.
Martin Kennedy, President of the National Farmers Union of Scotland, and a lot to talk about.
We're not live this morning. We're recording this on Friday morning at the Royal Highland Show at Ingolston. First time there's been a full show here since 2019. It's great to be back, isn't it?
Yeah, this is an interesting area. This is beside what's known as the countryside area. So there's a wee pond across there, and there's people paddling about, and it's all very peaceful and bacolic and things like that. And last night I was across there, and there was moorhens and moorhen chicks just cheeping away. Very, very nice. But as you can hear, there's a small boy beating, or two small boys beating something across there. This is the military section. So there is Poppy Scotland across there, 154th Scottish Regiment. I don't know what that thing is. Basically, it looks like a sort of bridge-building device. I have no idea. There are Royal Military Police recruiting now, flashing blue lights on the military police car. But behind us, it's a beast.
Yeah, military Chinook, but shorter than the ones you might see. They've got machine guns. We were going to go on it,
but there's a huge queue.
Huge queue. I mean, we're going to do the BBC thing.
Excuse
BBC,
us, don't you know who we are?
We're maturing. We're maturing. But it does look spectacular.
Have you flown on one of these things?
I've flown quite a lot of these things, and they're scary. Very, very scary.
It's about the size of a single-decker bus.
Yeah.
But it's got rotors fore and aft.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a beast.
It's a bit of a beast. And I always wanted to fly one.
Why did they never let you?
My attitude.
How difficult could it be?
Exactly. There's still loads coming up, including the Shorthorn Cattle Society. And they're celebrating 200 years of their herd book, the oldest herd book in the world. What is a herd book? I have no idea, but we are going to find out. Plus, Mass Fisher-Moller, a professor in food policy with Scotland Rural College, what are we doing right in terms of food production, and what could be doing better?
This is actually blessedly cool. There's a big tent which contains all the pens for the sheep, and this got my attention. It's not the sheep we're looking for, but look, cootied down into the store right at the back there, a couple of very cute lambs, but in the foreground, what looks the handmaiden of Beelzebub?
This is the Hebridean sheep.
Yeah.
Looks kind of like a Jacob sheep. I mean, it's got wee skinny legs.
Aye.
and a kind of solid body. Body's too big for the legs. But what a head. I mean, that's phenomenal. If you were reading Tam O'Shanter on a scary night, that appeared.
Essentially, what you've got are these two horns coming out, you know, it's almost like a spout of water coming out of a whale's head. But there are two other horns which curve underneath and actually meet under, more or less meet underneath its chin.
There's a man with a rosette.
These yours?
Yes.
Ah, right. Okay, sorry, who are you?
So I'm Jack Cuthbert. This is Ardoch Hebridean Sheep. So that's Ardoch Excalibur. He's 6 years old.
Excalibur, fantastic.
So he was third today. And this is Ardoch Indiana Jones, and he was fifth today. So
Why Indiana Jones? We
run with a series of letters, and when you get to I, there's not that many names, if you know what I mean. So,
the fact that there's damage on the horn of that one, yeah. Excalibur, is that a problem?
Well, obviously you'd like something perfect, but he's 6 years old, so he's still fit, he's still got his teeth in, and he's still coming third today, so
yeah.
he's doing all right. We all kind of get a wee bit greyer, and we all have a few chips on the side.
That's true.
So why keep them?
So the Hebrideans are fantastic breeds, great for conservation grazing. We do a lot of meat supply to restaurants and home cooks and producers. So it has a number of ways of kind of bringing itself to the commercial market, albeit it's a wee bit more smaller and it's a primitive sheep. But
can you get a premium on that? Because they are, compared to some of the bigger breeds, they're quite small.
Yeah. So, you need an extra pound per kilo sort of thing in relation to the sort of size of the carcass that you're putting on. But, you know, the reality is it's really good. We don't sell it as lamb, so it either goes as hogget, which is a sort of year to 2 years, usually from a year and a half onwards, or mutton. So it's that kind of time for things. So,
what does it taste like? Because I find lamb quite buttery, fatty in taste sometimes, unless you cut it with something?
Well, it's got a different level of fat in it, so it's quite a primitive fat. It kind of puts a lot of fat around its kidneys inside and doesn't have too much on the outside. Okay. So you kind of give it a high crisp roast, caramelization on the outside with a bit of sweetness and a gaminess sort of thing is how you describe it. And, you know, people that maybe don't like lamb with a wee bit of that fatty taste, it doesn't have that, because what happens is, because it's been a primitive, it's designed to go, right, I need energy, release that fat, and when you put it in the oven and you put it on high heat, it drops all that fat into your tatties or whatever, your vegetables underneath.
I've sold this before.
Once or twice.
Listen, well done, congratulations.
No, thank you very much.
Delighted with it. Now, livestock is a huge part of the Highland Show. At the show this year, there's almost 1,000 head of cattle and around 2,000 sheep, plus all the horses and goats and chickens and everything else. We've got more of those later. This year, there are two brand new sheep classes, Dutch Spotted and something called Valley Blacknose. Now, a couple of weeks ago, I visited Raymond Irvin, who farms with his fiancée Jenny near Tom and Towel, to find out more about their exceptionally aesthetically pleasing Swiss flock.
Come on.
They're not for it, are they? What are these, and describe them to me?
So these are a Swiss breed. They're a Valley Blacknose from Valleys region in Switzerland. They are, a lot of people call them the cutest sheep in the world, and I've not seen anything more cuter than this. They're woolly, they've got big long fringes on them, they've got fluffy legs, they've got four knee patches, and they've got four wee black boots as well.
Yeah. Basically, it's not a black nose so much as a black face, and the ears are black as well, and then, as you say, they've got these black knees. The wool itself almost seems like sort of like a Rastafarian approach to sheep.
It's got a beautiful, the wool's got a beautiful crimp, and especially on the lambs, it's just a lovely, lovely fleece. And, you know, we get a lot of felters who love working with this wool, and the amount of people we have, you know, asking for the wool, actually, just to try it.
Has it got a value? Because, I mean, the vast majority of sheep farmers will tell you that they take the fleece off for the benefit of the sheep, and it's worthless.
Yeah. When we first came in here, you know, we were selling the fleeces for £25, £35 a fleece, which was incredible.
Happy days.
Yeah, happy days, of course. But now they've gotten more popular. There would be about 3,000-4,000 of these sheep in the UK now after the 8 years of us getting them in. So the wool now is not so popular. Mm-hmm. The wool's kind of, it's quite tough, right. So it would be good for outerwear.
or carpeting or
carpeting, something. Felting. Yeah. It's mostly felters that are taking it now from us. But because it's so common now, it's actually not worth that much. So we would probably get about the same as you get for a Blackie Fleece, which is, what, 150, 180?
Yeah, three and threepence.
Be lucky. Yeah. But for a shearer, it's a shearer's nightmare, actually, to shear these. I've heard some of the shearers, they'll not shear these unless they get about £8-9 for them to shear it. So we're losing now.
I can imagine. And the terrain they live in Switzerland, how high up are they? How similar is it to this?
Yeah, well, here we are about 200 metres up. In Switzerland, where they go in the summer, is nearly 4,000 to 5,000 metres up.
Wow.
But over there, it was a funny thing, when we first got these, we made friends with some of the guys over there, and we got a couple of their best sheep. And the only reason we got a couple of their best sheep was because they had problems with the wolf over there. Mm-hmm. And they didn't want their really good sheep getting eaten by the wolf.
That's just extraordinary. Just extraordinary. And I know that you're going to be showing these at the Royal Highland Show.
Yeah.
This is the first time they've actually had a showing class at Ingolston. What do you have to do to prepare them?
On the day of the show, we're not going to have to do much because everything's going to be done at home. All the preparation is done at home. You know, all they have to do is look cute, look good. The judge is going to have to look, you know, you look for, like any other breed, confirmation, the spots in the right place, a nice length of wool right down the body, down the legs. The legs have to be really woolly as well. Mm-hmm. They need to have the black face, the black nose, the black ears. The girls have got black patches under their tails, where the boys don't. Mm-hmm. And if the boys have a black patch under the tail, well, it's a no-no. It's out. So we also look for locomotion, legs, the way they show themselves. It's a bit similar to any other breed as well, but more about the look, the cuteness, the overall appearance.
You could hear the bell in the background there. What's the purpose? Because only one of them I can see is wearing a bell.
Yeah, there's one in the bell there. That's our quietest one. So they all follow her around the field. So, and it just calms them down. Uh-huh. And I think it's quite relaxing too.
I love it. Right. I know, I absolutely love it. And do you have to clean them before the show?
Yeah, so on Sunday, we'll brush off all the tangled bits and the knots. All that will be taken out. So the legs will be well looked after to make everyone puff out and look good on the day.
Yeah. And how do you wash them?
We've got a hot tub at home. That's the truth. Yeah. That's the truth.
We've Bags got, out of the hot tub
we,
first.
We've got a hot tub, and in Switzerland we watched them do it, and they did it in a bath. Mm-hmm. And I thought, we could do it a bit better. We'll do it in the hot tub.
Yeah.
And I don't use it anymore. But the good thing about the hot tub, it gets it to the temperature we need. Mm-hmm. And a little bit of ingredients after that, and yeah, you know, away we go.
No great problem. I asked you about the fleece. What about the meat?
The meat in Switzerland is really, really good. This meat, I've tried it over here, and it has got that unique, that you don't smell the fat, the lamby smell.
I know exactly what you're talking about. It's almost a sort of buttery smell comes off lamb.
Yeah, and their meat is so soft. Yeah. These sheep are not every farmer's cup of tea, because they always come up to the show and they feel it's bad and they go, oh, Jesus, I've cut my hand. And But, you know, they're a lean meat. We don't push them for a fatty meat. They're a lean meat, but they're a tasty, tasty lean meat. And we've actually put them to a hotel. They can't get enough of it.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I mean, I can agree with you more. They are seriously cute animals.
Yeah.
But you can't have just picked a breed of sheep because they were cute. Or did you?
Well, it was Jenny, my fiancée, that picked it.
Oh, yeah, blame her.
And, you know, if you want to keep a woman in the back of beyond up here in the Highlands, I think you've got to have some kind of interest together.
One last question. You know, these things are getting more common, but they're not at all common. How difficult is it finding a judge for a showing class?
This year, as a society, there was five of us went over and they trained us for a week to grade the sheep. So what we have this year is a lad called David Hodge, who is our chairman of the society. He's judging the sheep, and he's a trained, and he's got the certificate as well, as a trained grader and judge for the sheep. So he should know what he's doing.
That was Raymond Irvine up in Tom and Towel, and we've actually cornered them here at the sheep stands at the Royal Highland Show here at Ingolston. This thing's ready to go.
Well, I think this is my star of the day. I think for me, I hope he does. He performs really well. This is Highland Hero. Mm-hmm. He's a two shear, and he's looking.
What's
just
a two shear?
It's like he's 2.5 year old.
So he's only been shown twice.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm not sure if he would class out with Valley Blatnose because they get sheared twice a year. So he could be a four shear.
You're talking to people who know very little about this, so we'll try and keep it simple.
So he's 2.5 years old.
Right, okay. Mark, because I said to Mark, what we're looking for, he said, trust me, you'll know they're the cutest things in the world. And I took it with a pinch of salt. These are gorgeous.
They're just like teddy bears.
Absolutely, you know, beautiful.
Yeah, there's some people that go, what do we look for? I says, well, you know, it's like a teddy bear, you know. It's your first ever teddy bear, then, you know, it's something that's really cute. And I don't think you can get a cuter sheep than what these are.
When are they going to judge these?
These are on at 3 o'clock, so we've got about a couple of hours to prepare, so okay. I'm looking forward to it. So.
And basically, I watched somebody actually preparing earlier today, and they're just brushing everything out very, very carefully. It seemed quite a zen process.
Well, these are actually different. You don't want to touch the fleece itself. What you want to do is brush out the legs and the head. That's all we need to do. Leave the rest natural.
Do you know, I feel sorry for somebody that's trying to compete with a Texel. And then you walk in with one of these.
Why did you pick Texel particularly?
I have no idea, just a breed.
You don't think Texel are as attractive?
There is a school of thought that suggests they're very like frogs.
They're very, very like frogs. Some people think we do.
I think everybody's got their own taste, so...
Yeah, I'm kind of wee.
I like the wee cuddly things.
What a diplomat. Listen, good luck this afternoon.
I hope you do well
with it.
Thank you.
And then following on from that, as you can hear, we've got the horses behind us, and the tannoy is in full voice.
They are loud, but they are quite informative, and it attracts crowds from all over the place. I don't know anything about this, but it's incredibly popular.
The list of stuff at this show that we don't know anything about is really quite extensive.
Well, it's growing by the minute.
Yeah, well, shorthorn cattle. Who knew that they came in such a dazzling array of colours of red? I've got more on that coming up. We're actually at an area I try personally to avoid because it's down beside the horsey vendors. They've got all the stuff here that you can buy. And we've got enough stuff at home already, I would have thought.
You could start.
We could start our own, seriously. We could. Not a problem at all. But, you know, the jumping has just been behind us. They've got a lovely surface here. You know, I was watching some of the rounds yesterday, you know, and, you know, we tooty riders on these horses, I mean, barely, you know, just slightly over ponies barely over pony height, I would say. And the sticks they were jumping were terrifying.
I'm not expecting you to be an expert on this.
Good.
Is the Highland Show a bit of a player when it comes to horses?
Yeah. It's a qualifier for some of the really big events down south. So, you know, people come here and they try their very, very hardest in showing classes and jumping classes and everything else.
I said earlier on, we're not live today, but you can get in touch by email, outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Tell us what your experience of this show has been, or tell us what you're doing in the Great Scottish Outdoors.
An event on this scale doesn't just happen. There are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people involved in organising it. And pretty much as soon as this year's event finishes, planning will start for next year. Some of that work falls to the directors of the Royal Highland and Agricultural Society of Scotland, and Aylett Rowan is one of them. A woman with a lot of badges, so I asked her, what qualifies you to be doing such an important job?
Well, qualified, I don't have any qualifications. That's why I'm self-employed.
Snap.
I have been, since the age of 11, been on farms. That's got bitten by it, loved it. That's all I ever wanted to do. Left school early at 15, went on to agricultural college, pursued that, stayed working, then met my husband, which puts me down in Dumfries and Galloway on a dairy beef and sheep farm. And we also have a milk delivery business through that and a pop-up milkshake bar, which is at the show as well.
That seems like an incredible workload when you add it on to being a director.
It is. They say about boards are made up of older men and things like that, and that's how it is. But until you're actually in it, you can understand why that is, because there's a point in your life where if you don't have so many responsibilities and a bit more freedom, because it does take up a lot of time. But because of the way we're set up, and you need a passion to help drive you on, and it makes your business better if you're out and about, and that's what I find it. Continued personal development, that's how I see it.
Are you not heed bummer of women in farming too?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am the chair of Women in Agriculture, and we had our breakfast this morning, which the whole committee played a blinder, absolutely, really full to gunnels, really well received. It's great.
What is it about life on your farm that really appeals to you?
Oh, so much, actually. We are very fortunate. We're in a beautiful spot of Dumfries and Galloway. So you can just look out and it's just lush green grass. We're in the perfect spot for growing grass. Husband's family have been milking dairy cows there for over six generations. I don't know, because you can spend the day cursing and just you're too busy to get on with jobs, yet every day you just get up and you do it again. It's in your blood, you love it.
But it is evolving.
Oh, everything changes. Well, we milk with robots. We have two Lely robots on the farm, which changed the dairy side of it for us, which we're very fortunate. It's been brilliant. But we also have beef cows and sheep as well, so quite labour-intensive and very busy.
How big is your herd?
We have 120 pedigree Holstein Friesians, because we only have two robots, so you're limited to how many cows can milk through.
You better explain the robot, because I'm sure folk have got a different image of
that. I've got a wonderful image.
Well, Johnny Five.
A robot with kind of yoke in a bucket.
So they're called boxes almost, so like a booth that the cow has a collar around her neck with a transponder on, and it reads her, and she'll walk in, and it has all her information on there, and it gives her the right amount of food, and it will find out her weight, anything that's going on with her.
Check
and
her she gets milk. All that kind of stuff.
Oh, definitely, all these bits and bobs, the health management side of it. And she'll stand in there and she'll get milked, and they love it. They queue up and they're desperate to get in, and then she'll move out, so it's free access as well. We don't put them in, they come in, they have permissions, they milk about 3.5 times a day. So, yeah, it's been the making of the herd for us.
There's just hordes and hordes of children coming out. It's fantastic.
Oh, the whole show field is absolutely alive. Yeah. I mean, all these negative nannies that keep going on about points and, oh, nobody will turn up. The place is absolutely heaving. The rings are like six deep in people watching what's going on. It's amazing.
This is the first time either of us can remember the number of people coming into the show being capped. Why was that decision taken?
So it's been something that's been ongoing for a couple of years, but of course we've not had a show being going on. All down to health and safety as well, because there was so much of freedom. Everybody's moving around. You're not going in one gate, sitting down, staying still, that's it. Everybody's moving around, and there's livestock and animals, and then obviously your services as well. It just comes down to that. That's what the capacity of the show field
not
is.
Not COVID.
No, not COVID. It would have been at some point, but no, this is just the safety of everyone and for comfort of everybody. Nobody wants to be getting all jammed up at cattle crossings.
It's easier to move around, though. Yeah. You were commenting on that. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of space, and it's great.
Aye, and aside from capping the numbers, this year, for the first time, you cannot rock up at the show and buy a ticket. Mm-hmm. You've got to do it in advance.
You do have to do it in advance. Friday and Saturday are now sold out. Fantastic. You can actually still just rock up, and as long as you've got your phone or another type of electronic device, you can just log on to the website and buy your ticket through that way. It's all to do with the control of numbers, and it's the way it is. It's different. Everybody, for goodness knows how many years, have always just rocked up, paid at the gate and got in, and it's changed. Nobody, humans, we don't like change, but it's a necessary, and it will be good, and people will be grateful in the long run.
If I can take you down the badge there, Chief Steward of Goats, do you keep goats?
No,
or did you just got the short straw?
It's not a short straw, not at all. No, the last gentleman that was the chief steward, he retired from the board, and there was an opening, and it was the time that I was coming in, and you need a position, so it fell to me, and it was like I did start with. I think, well, hang on a minute, I have better qualities for that, but it's great. The goat seemed to be the unsung hero, and if you go down there, I mean, the tent is absolutely filled with people. They love it. The goats, every single goat has this mischievous look upon its face. They're great. They're trying to eat all the hanging baskets that the owners have put up to make the place look nice, and these goats are trying to reach up and eat them. It's just, why wouldn't you want it? It's great.
Aylett Rowan there, and we're on our way to take it up on our personal recommendation to actually find out more about the goats.
Yeah, but we're not quite there yet, because anybody who's been at the Highland Show will know a major feature is, you know, the horses that we've been talking about. To get the horses out of the horsey bit and into the ring bit, they close the gates for the safety of the public. Some people get really unnerved by it, but as they shut the gates, it's always a moment to relax and think about things and enjoy it.
Yeah, I'll tell you who wasn't relaxing and thinking about things and just enjoying it. I watched it yesterday. They shut the gates, right?
there's a primary school teacher, a bloke, on one side who managed to get stuck in the middle with his class on one side of the gates and three or four kids on this side of the gates wandering off. And he had this very fast, very heated discussion saying, no, I need to get through. And the sorry, horses are coming through.
And
I'm sure they got the kids back eventually.
From your story about kids to goats.
We're off to meet a lady called Becky Campbell.
So these are British Toggenberg goats. They're a breed of dairy goat that's been developed from goats originally from Switzerland, but developed in the UK for quite a number of years now.
And they've got a lovely, almost like a red deer quality of colour to it.
Yeah.
And very different from your mum's ones, which are white and kind of more ugly.
I mean, I think it's down to personal preference. So the British Toggenbergs, they can be a variety of different brown shades, from quite a sort of silver colour to quite a dark chocolate brown. But yeah, they come in lots of different colours.
And do you actually milk yours?
Yeah, so we hand milk all our goats. We have 8 milkers at home. We hand milk them every day, twice a day. I'm always there down at the goats.
What's the attraction of goats for you? I mean, that one's gorgeous.
Yeah.
It's a lovely black stripe around it, and it's just such a cool-looking animal. It's like a rabbit with attitude.
They're really different-looking. So we got into them because my mum couldn't digest cow's milk as a baby, so my granny was the first one to get them, and we've had them for 54 years now. So
I have a feeling I'm probably going to regret asking this, but why is goat's milk different to cow's milk?
Well, it's a different difference in the proteins and the fats. I'm not really sure about the
you
science
just milk
of
them,
it.
You don't care about the details.
I think it tastes better than cow's milk on a personal sort of preference of taste.
So is this a commercial operation?
No, not for us. We do make our own cheese for our own use, but we don't have a dairy, so it's all hobby. We breed them as pedigree animals for showing is the main thing that we do. But they're also lovely pets as well, very good companions.
Those little floppy bits of skin.
Yes.
This one's eating my hand. hanging down off our necks. What's the purpose of those?
There's no purpose. That is the most asked question at every goat show that we ever go to, is what are those dangly things on their neck? And they're called tassels or toggles, but they have no...
There must be a purpose.
Well,
Nothing in nature develops just for the hell of it.
There's definitely no purpose now. They're reminiscent of like musk deer, so it could be a potentially a remnant of a musk gland, but they definitely have no purpose now.
You said they're really good pets.
Yes.
How good are they?
I think that goats are probably one of the most emotionally intelligent animals that there are.
I think
they are. I mean, maybe not quite as much as dogs. They're more fond of me than my dog is of me.
Give me an example that stands that statement up.
Well, so we hand rear all of our goats, so they know us from birth. They think of us as their mothers, really. So when they then get to the stage where they're giving birth, they like me to be in the pen with them, keeping an eye on them, holding their hand, so to speak. And you can just tell, they come up to you, they cuddle you. They're always pleased to see you. They've got a look in their eye.
You've got about 30 goats here. What's a practical one? I might get in trouble when I get home. What's a practical number of goats you could have?
Well, so if you just want a goat for your own personal use, to provide like milk for your house, maybe make a little bit of cheese, you really only need one in milk. You always need more than one goat, though, because they need to be in at least a pair, and they like to have a little herd. So one goat can produce easily, we measure in kilos, like 5 to 6 kilos of milk, which is over a gallon of milk a day.
Do you have to get a billy goat as well, or do you hire one in?
Yeah, we own a billy goat, but you can take your goat to a billy goat to be mated, or you can bring a billy goat to you to be mated. There's a bit of a system.
Just in case he follows up on this typically rash idea, what breed of goat is idiot-proof?
I'm not sure that any of them are better than any other. They all require quite a lot of care.
These ones, you can't have any.
Look at the little ones. Look at them.
The basic goat to start with would be a non-producing dairy goat, because a pygmy goat or something that doesn't produce milk, because they don't need quite as much round-the-clock care. There's lots of different
Remember
options.
Being in a goat dairy down near Liverpool, which was beautiful, all whitewashed and what have you, and they had a sort of like a step that the goats kind of walked up so that they were at the right level for you milking. It was a clever thing to do. But the place was full of branches, like offcuts from trees and things like that.
Yeah, goats actually, they prefer to eat like things like branches and other forage as opposed to just grass. Like a sheep is maybe more likely to go into a field and just eat the grass, whereas the goat will go around looking for the weeds, it'll go around the hedges looking for stuff to eat that's other than grass. It's more interesting.
There's a whole market out there. Why is it not taking off? Why doesn't everybody have a goat?
No, I ask this question all the time. I think that everybody should have a goat, they don't... They don't take up a lot of room. You know, I know lots of people who keep goats in their back garden. They bring in
do
all
they
the
smell
food for them.
Is that just a myth?
The billy goats do smell.
What about the smell? Don't worry, the goat will get used to it. Becky Campbell and our goats there, you're tempted?
Very tempted. I mean, I think it's probably a lot of work, but they're just so beautiful. You know, the little ones as well, where that kind of, there's something about a goat that's got attitude.
Yeah.
You know, sheep is a sheep, but a goat, it's
you
a bright
that
thing.
Now, if you had to choose between the goat and the Valley Blacknose that we were talking to Raymond Irvine about earlier.
Ooh, a llama.
Listen, this is the fun part of it. This is the sort of, you know, this is beautiful. Very attractive. But we heard earlier from the NFUS about the difficulties facing farmers just now with rising costs, every cloud and all that. Could there be opportunities to be gained from this challenging situation? Is it time to actually look at the current paradigm and possibly change it? We spoke earlier to Professor of Food Policy at Scotland's Rural College, Mas Fisher-Muller.
There's huge disruption in food at the moment. There are luckily alternatives available. I haven't seen many here at Royal Highland Show, but we know from science and from what's happening elsewhere that alternatives are there. But we need to start having a proper conversation about what kind of farming system do we need in the future. And we need government to, quite frankly, step up and show us that there are paths that lead us forward that are different from just... I think they're looking a little bit too much in the rear mirror when they are making policy.
Give us an example of that new direction, that new vision.
Well, when I'm looking much towards Europe, what's happening in the rest of Europe. I can see farmers' unions and farmers are embracing plant protein. They can see that's going to be massive because consumers want it and because it's better for the planet, so it lowers carbon emission from our food. I can also see a move towards agroecological practices, especially organics. The good thing about that in the current situation is that they have far lower input costs. So if you go towards more regenerative farming practices, more organics, you actually have lower costs. I was talking with a dairy farmer here at the Royal Highland Show, and he's converted from conventional to organic simply because he couldn't afford the input costs, and now he has made a thriving business going organic because it lowered his input costs, so he was able to opt for organic simply because it was better for the bottom line of his business. I think that's two of the options that are available for us.
I suspect you may not want to hear this. I really, really don't like the idea of lab-grown meat.
I'm not really big on lab-grown meats either, but we probably have to think of food as, well, see the reality of how we eat at the moment is that we are actually only 18% of our meals are meals cooked from scratch here in Scotland. The rest is assembled or fast food or something like that. I think lab-grown meat and plant protein might have a role to play as a substitute in our McDonald's burger or in our ready-made meal that we pick up from Tesco's. But I don't think that lab-grown meat will substitute the steaks. And I think there'll still be plenty of room for high-quality meat production from Scotland to have the good steak. But I think some of the lowest-quality meat and the meals that where we aren't thinking too much about what we're consuming, we're just throwing something in our head, which is many of the meals, to be frank. I think lab-grown meat and plant protein might have a role to play there, but I am not the one who will agitate for lab-grown steaks in the near future.
It possibly needs a change of title as well, but if I take you back to organics, in Scotland and Britain, we're way behind Europe in organics, and countries like Denmark are streets ahead.
I came to Scotland 2 years ago, and that's quite frankly what shocked me the most, was the lack of organics. Even in a wealthy area like Edinburgh, where I live, it's still hard to find many of the products that I just expect as organics. And the good thing about organics is government doesn't have to pay a whole lot because it's a way to get the consumers to pay for the green transition we want. So that's also what I want to show to Scottish stakeholders, not least the Scottish government. Organics is a way, it's a market-based solution to make our food system more green.
Is there anything in Scottish farming at the moment, and you know, any of the traditional sectors that you look at and really admire?
Yes, I really admire the way that the farming system in Scotland is able to have farming and nature and take that role as stewards of the land to heart. I think that's brilliant compared to a place like Denmark, where everything in Denmark is just ploughed up and every square inch is used for production. Here, there is an understanding that the land is for more than just farming. So that's really, really beautiful, and I love that. I also, just going around here, there's a lot of innovations going on. I've had, just in my bag here, crisps made of leftover broccoli that couldn't go into the supermarkets because they weren't to the high enough standard. And then they make those low standard broccoli into crisps that I hopefully can feed to my kids, and they will have healthier crisps, and we will have eliminated food waste. There's a lot of inspiring ideas out there. What I sometimes lack is that the National Farmers Union, the big players in the Scottish Government, quite frankly, are embracing that innovative spirit and try to support that a little bit more and nurture the good ideas a little bit better. We need to do that because we need all the little good ideas that can show us a path forward that will make farming ultimately more sustainable and more profitable, and hopefully also more healthy. We reduce food waste, farm more in accordance with nature, and we have to change our diet slightly away from the heavy reliance on meat and a little bit less meat. I think if we do all of those three, we'll be in a good spot for the future.
You spoke earlier about, you know, looking to the future to try to do things differently. Is there any sense in which we should be looking to the past, the way things once were done, you know, and going back to systems that we turned our back on years ago?
Yeah, back to the future is not a bad place to be when it comes to farming. I think we probably have to see two systems that work parallel to one another. One that looks a bit backwards, you can say, where we have a more holistic, circular thinking in our food system, rotations and livestock in a mix of crops, etc. So more, you could say, an organic and agroecological position, hopefully even with livestock production in forests, etc. So going really back to some of the solutions. And then we have to also go towards the future. Maybe not lab-grown meat, but maybe plant proteins, maybe vertical farming. We have to understand that at the moment, farming is taking up a lot of our lands, and of all the farmland in Scotland, 85% is used to feed our animals. So if we just reduce animal consumption a little bit, reduce animal production a little bit, and have more, you could say, high-rise farming, so to say, intensive farming on smaller space, that would be another path. So we can have look to the past for the services it provides when it comes to nature, climate, and then to the future when it comes to intensive farming and produce enough to feed a world population approaching 10 billion people.
Professor Mads Fisher-Moyla, Professor in Food Policy with Scotland's Rural College. We'll hear more on the innovations coming out of SRUC shortly.
He was saying a lot of things that I hadn't even thought of. That whole organic route, which has always been seen a wee bit happy-clappy, left the field, making a lot of sense for inputs.
Yeah. And the idea of farming vertically too. You know, I don't know where the end truth is going to be. I suspect somewhere in the middle ground, the combination of what we would regard as traditional farming and different farming.
Yeah, but a long way ahead. We've moved into a slightly noisier environment.
Uh-huh. This yeah, it's Craigieburn Poultry, right? They've got umpteen different types of chicken here. The one that really caught my attention was that, the Buff Orpington Cockerel, which is about the size of two rugby balls and has got a bit of an attitude.
See, that could pull a cart. You'd need a bowler hat to have one of them.
Something like that. Look. The kids have been fascinated with those.
This is brilliant. They just move up a wee bit.
They've got eggs that are hatching out here, and the chicks are inside a little incubator. The kids are absolutely fascinated now. Just cheeping away.
It must be a nightmare trying to get them to hatch out on a specific day.
They've probably got thousands of them. You could probably pick, I don't know. They've got ducks in the centre there too. It does say Craigieburn Poultry, not just chickens.
And they've got crazy ones.
Yeah. Oh, wow. The Polish and the Peking, or Pekin. Cuckoo Marin. I never even heard of that.
Yeah, this is not a strange one. The dog hasn't heard of it either, obviously.
No, exactly.
Look at that. Sorry, that's not very descriptive for radio.
It's not... saying it's a broody silky hen with chicks. Can you see how many she has? Well, I can see one.
I can see one. There's a lovely notice there saying they do escape. Don't worry, they will go back.
They'll go back in eventually.
But it's got a real sort of candy floss head on it. It's like an emu.
It is a wee bit like an emu. I must get, the way I was going to describe it, it looks like something you would use to actually clean up in busy corners. You know, take the dust out.
That might be noisy.
And how many chickens? This is a well summer broody hen with ducklings. It's a Dutch breed originating from the town of Velsum. Eggs dark brown.
Well, we'll go for nine. Yeah. These are actually beautiful birds.
You know, the pom-pom heads and things, and these slightly hooked beaks, the Polish ones.
Yeah, but that pom-pom on the top limits their vision, so I've got mixed feelings about
that's
that.
That's why I got rid of my hair. Yeah. That's why I got rid of mine, because I can see much better now.
Now you've stopped combing it forward.
Combing it over. You're listening to Outdoors here at BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElroy. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, you can catch up whenever you like by looking up the programme on BBC Sounds.
Or download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sound. Each year at the Royal Highland Show here, an area of Scotland gets highlighted. And it's a sort of showcase of the heritage, produce and industry of one particular part of the country. It harks back to the days when the show was peripatetic, when literally it moved about Scotland. This year it's the turn of the Highlands and Islands, and as a result, the honorary president of this year's show, Ewan MacDonald, hails from that area. We caught up with him yesterday at the Presidential Initiative Marquee, where he told us what he thought it was all about.
We are just down here representing our area as strongly as we can, and the feedback I'm getting at the moment is we've done a pretty good job.
And in the old days, the Highland Show was peripatetic. You used to physically go around all these areas. You know, so it would be in Aberdeen one year and, you know, wherever, you know, Inverness the next, whatever it was. Would you like to go back to the days where you said, right, fair enough, we're going to be basing it in Lewis this year?
Yeah, but you'd hit the local shows pretty hard. And finance comes into a lot of it. Because you've got all these permanent buildings, people don't realise what it costs to set this facility up. My friends in the Black Isle Show, my greatest friends, chair, president of the Nairn Show, and I'm going as a guest in 2 or 3 weeks' time, they're all struggling with costs this year. Marquees have doubled in price, power and heating is more expensive. They've just bought their own show field in Nairn. They're struggling with costs. Black Isle Show are struggling because a lot of business, well, classic example, one of the biggest brands in Scotland was sitting on my table, Sir Jim Walker. He's short of staff just now. They normally carry 1,500 staff. Walkers, they've only 1,350. And people, there's been one or two people that struggled to get here because the affordability and staff and time. Because it's a big, big thing coming to a show. And then if you demand on them to come to all the local shows as well, if a big show like this was to come to the area, it might have a huge effect on the local show like Tariff in your area. And I'm afraid to say, out of bad comes a little good. And COVID, people have had to think out of the box. We've had to do it in our business. People have learned to work more remotely, but people have learned to diversify more and think of more income stream. When my father was chairman in 79, he went on to be president. There were no hotels here. There was no tram here. You know, the infrastructure around Ingilston now is fantastic. And I think Ingilston's going to go from strength to strength.
I need to ask a little bit. 2 hours to get in.
Well, yeah, but how unfortunate. Well, they've had COVID, and what they have today, a train strike. That is unfortunate. Really is. It's really unlucky on them. So,
Where are you personally? Where are you actually based? What do you do?
I farm sheep, cattle, and cereals on the Black Isle, just a Dingwall, right next to Ross County, the best football club in the country.
Obviously.
Yeah. Well, what does it mean to be president?
Well, it's a great honour, you know, but my family have always been very closely connected. It was such a great honour. My younger brother flew in from America last night because the connection with the Highland Show. He said, I'm going to be there. I want to come in your honour and my late father's honour too. So,
did you do anything? Did you just swan round?
No, no.
And all your minions do it for you?
No. I am going now to a meeting with Scott. This is very important. A young lad from Gerloch, who I know, Steve McLean, but I haven't seen him since we did this deal. He is now the Director of Food and Marketing at Marks & Spencer's. I think he's called the Agricultural and Farming Director of Food and Marketing. We started a Highland Lamb label with him 2 years ago, and it's a great success, so I'm going to thank him. There's a lot of businesses done at the show. It's not what you know, it's who you know, and you meet a lot of people here you wouldn't meet otherwise. So we will have a lot of business connections over the next few days.
Sorry, I apologise.
Yeah, no, quite right. What do you do? But you meet a lot of interesting people. Yeah, for instance, if you've got a problem with a manufacturer like Massey Ferguson, John Deere, all of them, and I'm a Massey Ferguson and John Deere man, it's a great opportunity to meet the bosses. If you've got a problem, they're here. So you can go and face them up, which you don't get over the phone or an email nowadays. They're here. So you can go and do business. I'm going to go and do business with Marks & Spencer, Scott Beaches now. So you do a lot of business. It's not just a drinking fiasco, though my wife's just got the Ingleston House for a drink with the chairman's wife. But I'm getting about. I'm meeting people. I'm thanking people. I'm thanking a lot of people that supported us in this project. And the feedback we're getting from exhibitors is fantastic.
Ewan MacDonald there, Honorary President of the Royal Highland and Agricultural Society of Scotland, which is where we are.
Just, you can hear to the right-hand side of us there just now, there is this what we always call the forestry or chainsaw area, because the sound of chainsaws is constant. You went up those poles, didn't
yeah,
you?
These poles are, oh, I can't even remember how high
70,
they are.
80 feet,
70, 80 feet, and they said it'd be a good idea if we went up, and I raced on the far away one. Well, it was lovely.
You climb with spikes.
We actually went to the borders and saw the trees being cut down,
uh-huh.
And we followed them all the way, what put up here. Yeah, you climb up with spikes on your boots and you race up. Now, they put me up against an 85-year-old ex-forester on this
one. He wasn't 85, was he?
He was very old.
We've just grabbed hold of Graham Hutchin, who's the manager of the forestry, what's known as the forestry arena. We just described it as the chainsaw area. Because the sound of chainsaw never really stops.
No, it's always continuous kind of throughout the day, because they're creating some nice sculptures out of some cedar and wood and all kinds of offcuts.
We were making random guesses at the height of these poles.
Up to the buttons is 80 feet.
Spot on.
Yeah, and there's 13, 14 feet in the ground. They're 150 feet when we felled them. Yeah, and
I did it. And you very cruelly put me up against an older gentleman. Do you remember how old he was?
Oh, it was in his 70s, I think, didn't he?
Yeah.
He said 85 a minute ago.
No,
he was trying to make it
70s.
112.
No.
He went up in, I don't know, what, 12 seconds or something?
Yeah.
I just got,
3 days.
I peaked out in an hour and a half. And you got up the top there, it was windy, it was crazy. And it moves back and forward.
Yeah.
And all these kids at the bottom going, jump, jump, jump.
It is well secured in the ground. We check it every time.
Yeah, and then it came down, hands were bleeding. Kind of ripped a bit of my jeans. And the cameraman was over here. And he said, Ewan, can you do it again? I wasn't running.
One of the things I always like about this is the smell of wood.
It is, it's lovely.
I love that.
We say it's in the blood.
Yeah.
I've tried to get out the industry a few times, but it just keeps crawling you back in.
I'm glad we caught you. Listen, thanks very much for your time.
All the best. Have a good
day. Nice talking to you. A few weeks ago, I was actually down in Dumfries and Galloway, down in the southwest of Scotland, and spoke to a guy there called Patrick Laurie. Now, Patrick wrote a beautiful book called Native about his experiences of farming down there.
Yeah, he also weaves in his deep concerns about biodiversity and the plight of the curlew in particular, but also farming practices and the land in general.
Now, as I said, I went to visit him on his family farm in Galloway. It took some finding. And when I asked him about the future, he described some of the problems he's currently encountering, just trying to get hold of more land.
I would love to buy some land. I'd love to buy a substantial amount of land linked to this place, which would just give it the security it needs and give myself the ability to really make this whole thing work. But that's just impossible. That's just that I've been putting in offers and looking for land for a while, and it's just absolutely impossible.
Who's outbidding you?
I wish I knew. It's not.
It's not your neighbours.
It's certainly not my neighbours. I would say 10 years ago, it was some local forestry companies acting on behalf of investors. Now it's mega investors who make the big guys look like minnows now. So all around a piece of hill ground I've got, a lot of that's been changing hands recently. There's an Austrian company that's bought a lot of stuff. There's an American company, an engineering firm based in, I think it was Dallas or Austin. They're buying land through agents. The kind of grazing I'm looking for is sort of rough hill grazing. About 2012, it was valued about £850 an acre. It's now reckoned to be about £7,500-£8,000 an acre. That's not agricultural value. And again, that's why it's going to pension groups, investment groups.
Green Lairds,
absolutely. But it's interesting then, the Green Lairds argument is always like a Highland argument. And fine, I'm not being chippy about it, because I agree the Highlands have got a unique story, but like, stuff happens here that if it happens in the Highlands, people would be absolutely hitting the roof about it.
That's just hard.
In terms of how land is changing hands at the moment, and how tenants are being put off, farming tenants being prevented from buying land in preference of just the biggest buck wins, basically.
Who should be getting that by the scruff of the neck? Is that a job for the Scottish Government?
That is a job for the Scottish Government and Scottish Land Commission, and actually, encouragingly, both are doing really good stuff on it. But at the same time, it's happened in the last 18 months here. But we've got a report promised, we've got action promised. I think it's probably a relatively open secret now that by the time we get on top of this in Galloway, it's gone, it's done. And so I'm starting to look at how we take what happened here and make sure the rest of Scotland doesn't happen across larger areas of the rest of Scotland. But you can drive now, big pieces of country now. You could be damn sure you'd never meet the landowner.
How would you set, say we made you king for the day, maybe take a week, but Right. Let's say king for a week.
Don't just fob me off with a Sunday either. I want a full proper working day as well.
You want a full proper working day too? Okay, yeah. Fine, okay, yeah. Right, well, we'll call it Wednesday.
Okay, yeah.
Right. How would you set the value of land?
Again, it's back to some of the really, really close-grained discussions about carbon and sustainability. You've got to take a bigger picture and factor in all of the many things which historically in Scotland we've been really bad at factoring in terms of land value. And you've got to look at things like biodiversity, you've got to look at things about community access, you've got to look about community ownership. At the moment, land values in Galloway have gone absolutely through the roof because people are interested in one thing. And actually on a piece of ground where I did some consultancy recently, the hill ground had been bought. And the owners in Denmark, commissioned ecologists in Scotland to say, we want to plant this with trees, but we want to see what else we can do with it in terms of its multiple outcomes. We want to get the best of this piece of land. So I was brought in as a consultant to see whether or not it would be suitable for cattle grazing. And I wrote them a report on it. And I went out for the day and looked at this place. And the owners in Denmark didn't know that it had already been planted. And it had already been planted in such a way that it now can never be grazed by cattle. The story was over by the time the landowners even asked.
That's actually quite depressing.
It's hugely depressing, and I love the place. And you know, there's an old farmhouse up on the back of it. I spent the whole day on this hill. There's an old farmhouse there, and somebody had come 5 years ago, 10 years ago, however long, mouldy pieces of paper pinned up to the wall, and it was a poem that had been written about the last family that had lived in that house. And I don't know who had stuck it up there, but I took photographs of it. And it was all the story of John so-and-so and his son. Old granny was buried in the garden. And it was all this very dear, close connection to this place. And then you walk back out the rubbly old door and it was just the whole hill just completely planted with trees. And it'll never be that again. And it was owned by people who'll never go and see it. And the work done by contractors who came out of Carlisle, came out of North of England somewhere. That's why when I say... It's not that what happens here is better or worse than the Highlands, but I feel that the Highlands have got a better vehicle to communicate some of this stuff, because it's a similar gut punch and it's a similar sense of this just can't quite be right.
But this isn't just sentiment on your part. It's not just being a bit sappy, because I mean, let's face it, that land is being productive. It's growing trees. Mm-hmm. It's doing something useful. Why is having people thorough to the land, having that emotional connection, important?
Whatever you do with a piece of ground, you've got to have that baked right the way through to it. My particular objection is when I heard, back to that example of the people who brought me in to see what else was possible, I quite agree that we need this kind of timber, we need to make the best use of productive land, we can't mess about the same way we did 100 years ago, 200 years ago, everything needs to be tighter now. But for me, there's loads of opportunities to take a really balanced, integrated approach and knit in as much good stuff as you possibly can and get people, local people who really care about a place, and make sure that you're balancing all sorts of different things. As soon as you make that step to go to forestry with that forestry hat on, you start closing those doors down and you start to kind of just bust up or knacker any alchemy that might come out of working stuff together in the future.
Farmer and author Patrick Laurie there, and you can hear the full conversation on the latest edition of the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available now on BBC Sounds. What he was talking about, you know, this idea of so-called green lairds buying up land for forestry, and the point he was making that, you know, if this was happening in the Highlands, it would be viewed as a disaster. I'm not convinced it's not happening in the Highlands, but possibly for different reasons.
Well, something we should look at in the future, I think.
Yeah, and see how it actually goes. Now, we've stopped here because we came for a wander round... Well, we were looking for tractors, and we found this, which is... I mean, to be honest, I have no idea what the hell this is.
It looks like a tank.
It does a bit.
And there's even kind of tank-like things all over it.
Yeah.
But...
Yeah. But the person who does actually know what this thing is Jos Edema, who actually designed this. What is this?
Yes, this is a concept. So it's not just a machine, it is also software, a portal behind it, so you can manage your whole fleet and your whole farm in another way. Okay. So the machine is the attracting part, so you could say it's a tractor without a cab, but it is much more. So we started from a complete other starting point. So, for example, in our opinion, machines nowadays are much too heavy. So farmers try to be on a level of 1 kilo per square centimeter, which is actually already too high for in many conditions if you're talking about your soil. Here we are talking about 0.2 kilos per square centimeter. So that's, for example, a difference. The second thing is that you can plan your farm much better, which is also, if we are talking about resources, about food production, about fertilizer prices, energy, and this is already better. So
this is not a manned vehicle, though. This is it autonomous? Is it
it's
robotic?
Autonomous.
Autonomous.
Yeah, yeah,
so you tell it what to do, program it, and off it goes.
Yeah, but programming is actually the wrong word. You are making exactly the same decisions as a farmer as you are making today. So you normally you go into the field and making your decisions. Now you see your field on the screen from the top. And then you can say, okay, I want to start here, I want to end there, I want to have headlands, yes or no, how many headlands, and then you can also say to the system, do I want to run it on high capacity or the most economical way, and then the system is making the calculation, and the machine is going to do the job, but in the meantime, the machine is also collecting a lot of data, and automatically puts the data back into the system, so afterwards you can look very precisely what you have done, how much traction force, how much kilowatts was going into a square meter, what a fuel consumption was. But it can also tell you in the future things about how much weeds you do have in the field, stones you have in the field. So it is much more than only...
it's a data collector.
Yeah, exactly. It's also harvesting data. Yeah.
Joined as well now by Dr. Gregor Walsh, who's hardware development and general manager for the company behind the Soil Essentials. Is this the future?
We think so. We've been following the progress of this over the past year and a half or so, and we can see that automation is, you know, accelerating within agriculture. We're an innovative company, and we can see there's going to be an adoption to automation. It balances up the change of labour, the availability and the skilled labour that's available to support this type of thing. We think it's ready for Scottish soil, so it's here at the Highland Show this week for its Scottish debut, and next week it's going on a bit of a demo tour as well to actually put it to work and see what we can do.
It's quite a heavy looking brute from here. I say it looks a bit like a tank.
Obviously it can't be.
But it's quite short. Can it do the job of one of these big monster tractors over there?
Yeah, well, that's the interesting thing. So, I mean, it's a diesel-electric concept. So there's a diesel engine there in that vehicle powering an electric generator. So it's a very stable, consistent torque source. It's quite a heavy vehicle here, so you're about 6.8 tonnes empty, but you have the standard connections of normal implements. So whilst you may not have the scale to get the work done in a short period of window, you now have a vehicle that period of window extends over the night as an autonomous solution.
It's a tracked vehicle too, so presumably it can cope with quite serious slopes.
Yeah, and absolutely, and we're going to find that out next week as well. But no, it's a
tracked... Sit on that, Willie, no.
It's a tracked vehicle, so you're able to get that power into the ground, but as Joris says, you're able to have a really light footprint, so you're protecting the soil, but you're able to deliver the power in there efficiently.
You'll probably have an answer for this, but if it's working through the night, is there safety built in there? It would just worry me that it could go off on its own.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, Ewan. So, you know,
found it down the back of the pub, that kind of thing. Yeah.
There's various safety systems already built into that to meet the standards that allow it to work, and automotive industries push that forward for automation. So yeah, it's filled with sensors. It's connected to the portal. It's going to alert the user. It measures the current specific values that each things are going. Its fuel levels and so on.
So if I walk in front of it with my dog, it's going to stop.
Yeah, so there's what we call a reactive bumper, so it's a safety bumper, and that uses technology like ultrasound that you already see in your car for parking, radar or impact sensors, and these are all designed with safety in mind, and it'll come to a safe stop.
Have you got a presence online?
Absolutely.
Right, okay, well, it's called the AgBot Autonomous Tractor, just in case our description of it has not lived up to expectation.
It's almost possible. Have you sold any, or you get a lot of interest?
We're getting a lot of interest. So, say, this is its first visit here in Scotland, and a lot of interest, a lot of leads to follow up. and we welcome anyone next week to come and look at the demo days and actually see some Scottish stour coming out the back of an aglot.
So you're on the research farm in Dundee, Balruddery, on the 29th and 30th of June, and then Archfield Wall Garden on Friday the 1st of July. That's at Dalton in East Lothian.
Correct, that's it, yes.
Gregor and Jörs, thank you both very much for that. That's one of the most interesting things we've seen all day, I think. While we're on the subject of innovation, innovation in farming in Scotland takes all sorts of forms. We went along to Scotland's Rural College, SRUC stand, where it's very simple, but very, very elegant tank filled with edible plants.
I am Emily Hairstands. I am a first-year horticulture student at SRUC. I've recently left a pretty long career working in a university to grow plants, and it's been a really amazing transition.
We were just going past the SRUC stand and saw this, which really caught my attention.
It's pretty cool.
Because essentially it's a square meter, all right? That's the footprint of the entire thing, and it is, what, maybe 2 meters high, something like that? But there is a multiplicity of plants in there.
Yes, absolutely. So basically this is a representation of vertical farming, which arguably is the future of food production. There's only so much land that we can grow on, and we really need to go up because we need to produce exponentially more food in the future than we have in the past.
It's like a big freezer cabinet full of very, very healthy looking plants. Are these just grown for the event, or is this genuine?
So I will put my hands up and say that these have been grown for the event. These are actually
Shame
plug
on
plants.
You.
I know. So these are the plug plants. These are some of the plants that we've been giving away to people, because a really big purpose of Dandelion is to encourage everyone everywhere, but all over Scotland, to grow their own food. In the cubes, we have lemon balm, we have chives, we have lettuces. These are all things you can grow on your windowsill if you like.
You threw in the word dandelion there from nowhere. Explain
from nowhere.
Dandelion.
Okay, so we are representing the Dandelion Festival. The Dandelion Festival is a Scotland-wide grow, sow, share and harvest festival, which runs really the period of growing, which is spring to autumn. A big part of our focus is to encourage the next generation of growers. So we have a number of grow cubes in schools. We've given away 258,000 seed potatoes to kids in primary school. In addition to encouraging children, we're just trying to encourage the average person to get stuck in, to get involved in growing their own.
How feasible is this? Can you do it in natural light, because you've got almost looks like different colours?
It looks like LEDs or something, isn't it?
The full proper vertical farming setup is a really hyper-controlled environment with more carbon dioxide than your average environment and very specific lights. So what you can do with the lights is you can control the wavelength of the lights. So the example I was given earlier was the Met Office says that we will be having a barbecue summer or a barbecue weekend in a couple of weeks. So we will tweak the lights so that we have plenty of lettuce available for all those farmers.
Wow, you just turn up the lettuce.
Yeah, we turn up the lettuce. Exactly. Turn up the lettuce. Or we say, oh, it's going to be a washout. Let's change the lights a little bit so the plants grow a bit slower.
I think that's absolutely fascinating.
It's really cool. I mean, it's a bit science fiction-y, but that's what we kind of have to do with the future of growing.
How are you finding the transition from academia to actually getting your hands dirty?
It's way more fun. It's so much more fun. I started out with this and I was still working and I was acting as a student, and I said, you know, sack it. This is, just makes me so much happier. I love to grow vegetables. My kids love to grow vegetables. My kids love plants. We've got chickens. We're really stuck in with it. And I just think it's a physically and mentally healthier lifestyle.
But there's something so satisfying about it. And you're doing it on a small scale, so it's accessible to anyone. To go out and cut your lettuce and have it in the salad.
Oh, it's the best.
In under a minute.
It's the best. As a parent, there is nothing better for me than my kids saying, I want mummy carrots.
Mummy carrots.
And they go out and they pick the carrots and they wash them under the outside tap and they eat them with the greens on them. And it's the coolest thing ever. I just love it.
Emily Hairston's from SRUC there. I think you could roll those out commercially. I think it's a really good idea.
It's so small, as you said, not about a metre square. Mm-hmm. It's about the size of a big freezer, isn't it?
Yeah. About the size of a phone box, basically.
And if you linked that up with solar panels, mm-hmm. you could do that anywhere.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
As we mentioned right at the beginning of this programme, the Royal Highland Show is 200 years old this year, and purely coincidentally, so is the Beef Shorthorn Herd Book. It's the oldest in the world. Now, Helen went to meet judge and breeder from Kelso, James Playfair Hanny, to get the lowdown on the significance of the herd book, because to be frank, none of us knew what it was for, and what it means for the breed.
Now, the Couts Herd Book was the original pedigree register for bovine animals. George Coates in Yorkshire started it, and that was 200 years ago. And all pedigree recording systems are based on Coates Herd Book, the first one. So it is something that we're, you know, the breed should be pretty proud of. If we go back those 200 years ago, following the Napoleonic Wars, the Industrial Revolution happening at the same time, we in the UK had been subsistence farmers producing our own food. And with that Industrial Revolution, we moved into towns, which grew into cities, but there was no way of producing food. So agriculture had to change. And these shows, and again, it's the Royal Highland Show's bicentenary this year as well, these shows were started to demonstrate the new techniques available in agriculture for the human food supply chain, and we're still doing that today.
And here we are standing in the Shorthorn lines 200 years after the Highland Show started and this herd book started, and the breed is going from strength to strength, because it did go through a bit of a lull for a while, didn't it?
Yeah, we went through a period of decline in the 60s, 70s. Our UK cattle got far too small, too fat, not enough red meat production. Together with us joining the EU in the early 70s, we started importing European continental breeds, Charolais, Simmentals, Limousins, to name but some, from Europe, and they transformed our breed here in the UK. And at that stage, because our native breeds, the Shorthorns, the Anguses, the Herefords, were not competitive and producing what the market actually required, they lost popularity. So much so that the Beef Shorthorns actually entered the Rare Breed Survival Trust register. They were a rare breed.
What would you say are the defining features of the British Shorthorn? We've got some here in front of us.
So we have white, red, roan, red with a little white, white with a little red, dark roans, light roans, whatever. So there's variety. One of the great things about Shorthorns is at calving time, you don't know what colour calf you're going to get until it actually
appears. Always a surprise.
Always a surprise, yeah. Roan ones are fashionable.
Yeah, there's a few along here, actually.
And, yeah, they're pretty careful to look at. We've also got the Morrison scheme, who are now selling branded Shorthorn beef.
Can we go back to the herd book? Because I'm intrigued to know what the significance of a herd book is.
Well, if we go back to those 200 years when George Coates started, then a lot of the pioneers in the Shorthorn breed were the landed gentry. And it was a case of, yes, they were all looking for these good animals or better animals, but nobody was keeping any records. So there were a couple of people in the Teesdale area, County Durham, who thought, right, let's start writing these records down and maintaining. And George Coates was commissioned to write the book. Now, if you're going to go back, and then you've possibly read in your history book that Robert Bakewell at Dishley Park in Leicestershire was the original breeder of Longhorn cattle and Leicesters, English Leicesters, and was the man to fix his type by breeding selected animals together rather than just being a lottery. The Colling brothers from North Yorkshire went down and studied with Bakewell and his techniques. They came back, and the Colling brothers, Robert Colling in particular, provided George Coates with the majority of the information as to what was working. And okay, some of the pedigrees were possibly a little questionable, but they tell me that happens in the best of families. But that was the start.
Yeah.
And then the Aberdeen Angus breed. One of the pioneers of the Aberdeen Angus, Hugh Watson from Keeler at Newtyle, he went down to the Colling brothers and studied them, what they had been doing, and came back, and that was the foundations of the Aberdeen Angus breed. So we're all interlinked. And I enjoy looking back through the history.
Seeing the lines.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
do
yeah.
you have cattle that have descended from original beef shorthorn then? Can you trace that?
Yeah, I mean, we can. We have one family called Lovely that came through Aberdeenshire. And again, going way back to those early days, in England, they focused on a more milky dairy type. And our breeders in Scotland, early breeders in Scotland, were focusing on beef type.
Because I imagine these cattle that we're looking at just now are very different from the cattle who were being recorded 200 years ago.
Oh, exactly. And again, when the breed all started, red meat was not the fashion. It was actually lard. It was,
really?
Yeah, I mean...
So they were fatty then?
They were fat. You know, that was... Okay, there was some red meat, but the fat was the valuable bit because that was where the energy was. Industrial Revolution, folk were living on bread and dripping. But, you know, fat's now a dirty word, so we've had to change them and make them lean. And it's all about red meat production.
That was James Playfair Hannay speaking to Helen there about beef shorthorn cattle, and at long last we know what the herd book is for.
We finally know what a herd book is for, and it's a valuable thing. It's a really centre point in many of the societies. It's fascinating.
Cattle have herd books, and horses have got stud books. And right now what we've got is an absolutely beautiful pair of Highland ponies there, and all these Shetlands and things, but in a fabulous condition.
Yeah, they're all in pairs. Didn't quite catch it with the pairs by the same sire or something like
something
that.
Something like that.
But they're just beautifully matched.
Yeah.
And all the folk that are taken round are beautifully turned out as well.
Yeah.
And it's almost a lovely pastoral scene, isn't it?
And what I like about this is because these are native breeds, the ladies aren't wearing kilts. It's mostly female handlers on this. They've got, you know, the tartan skirts on. It's very smart.
It is very smart. You wonder if it makes any difference.
Do the horses know?
No.
Probably not.
Does it affect the judging if you're not smartly turned out?
I would have thought so. See, that's a whole tradition in horses, that you turn out well, you know, you are smart, as a show of respect for the judge or instructor or trainer, whatever it is.
Is that why you don't show horses?
It's one of the reasons. Sadly, that's it for this week. Don't forget our New Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available today at noon, and our midweek podcast, which features Helen Needham chatting to Orkney musician Graham Rory about his brilliant new album, The Arcadians of Hudson Bay, all about the Arcadians who set off for Canada in the 18th and 19th centuries, looking to improve their prospects and make a living in the fur trade. Until then, we've had a cracking time here.
The sun has been out, the best of animals in the country, happy people, relaxed people.
Yeah.
Just, it's a joy.
Too straight. From all of the team here at Ingleston, thanks for listening.